Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nicholas De Torrente, U.S. Executive Director of the group Doctors Without Borders, who assesses the Afghan refugee crisis since Washington began its bombing campaign against Afghanistan's Taliban government. Father Roy Bourgeois of the School of the Americas Watch, who discusses his group's upcoming November protest against terrorism at Fort Benning, Georgia, site of the U.S. Army's training facility for Latin American soldiers. And Roberto Rodriguez, syndicated columnist and activist who talks about the recent murder of leading Mexican human rights attorney Digna Ochoa and questions raised about the Mexican government's commitment to human rights. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For nearly a decade, the U.S. National Security Agency has been eavesdropping on the phone calls of the Saudi royal family. The intercepts show a regime in turmoil, full of deep-rooted corruption and a history of large contributions to radical Islamic groups. Starting in 1996, American intelligence learned that Saudi oil money was being funneled to Osama bin Laden's terror operations and to similar groups in Afghanistan, Lebanon, Yemen, and Central Asia. An unnamed American intelligence source told the New Yorker magazine's Seymour Hersh that 1996 was the year when bin Laden teamed up with other Islamic radicals to form a grand alliance and to plan global terrorist operations. The National Security Agency intercepts reveal a Saudi kingdom ripe with massive corruption. Prince Bandar, formerly an ambassador to London, Yemen, and the Soviet Union, talks openly about bilking millions in commissions. The September 11th terror attacks shook up many wealthy oil men who now fear the Saudi regime is unstable and that the oil fields in the Persian Gulf may be the next target for bin Laden and company. One longtime oil executive with deep ties with the Saudi kingdom told the New Yorker, "The war was declared by bin Laden, but there are thousands of bin Ladens. It is a new form of war. This fabulous military machine the U.S. has is completely worthless." On the edge of Managua, Nicaragua, beaten-up one-room shacks and a huge garbage dump dominate the skyline. Small fires fill the air with a pungent smell as scavengers, mostly children, quickly search for leftover copper, aluminium, and other reusable metals. Nearby, Eddie Perez, a local children's advocate, can hardly believe that such scenes still exist in Nicaragua. The 1979 Sandinista revolution was supposed to wipe out dire poverty. But the Sandinista era ended in 1990, when the U.S.-backed opposition beat the Sandinistas in an open election after a brutal 9-year war sponsored by Washington. Yet, Nicaraguan politics appear to be stuck in the 1980s Contra War. The upcoming presidential election on November the 4th pits 73-year-old businessman Enrique Bolaños of the ruling Constitutional Liberal Party versus Sandinista leader Daniel Ortega, who is downplaying his radical past and playing up a new Christian fervor. According to Mother Jones magazine, over the last several years, Ortega has disposed of much of the Sandinistas' leftist agenda in favor of secret deals with the Liberal Party and political patronage. Many prominent Sandinista activists from the 1980s have since left the party. But the Bush administration, fearing an Ortega win, has attempted to label a Sandinista candidate as a terrorist and pressured to leave the race a conservative party that could siphon critical votes from Washington's preferred candidate. The New Internationalist magazine reports that the signs of global warming are evident all over Alaska. In the summer, lakes are drying up, local roads are buckling from permafrost melts, and Indian villages are much more vulnerable to intense winter storms. Since the 1950s, the average temperature in Alaska has risen by 2 degrees Celsius and a full 4 degrees Celsius during the winter months. As a result, mountain glaciers are melting at a record rate. In addition, some spruce trees are dying off because bark beetles migrating north due to warm temperatures are now invading Alaska. The Eskimo village in Shishmaref in western Alaska is set on a low barrier island facing the Bering Sea. In recent years, erosion has eaten away at the island. For years, the island was protected by sea ice, but the sea ice is forming later every year, leaving the island's sandy soil at risk. In 1997, 9 Eskimo homes had to be moved so they would not be swept away during an intense storm. Village Erosion Coordinator Robert Ayatunguk laments, "We're in imminent danger here. Every year the waters are getting higher and higher, and if we get another big storm, this place is going to be wiped out in a matter of hours." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.
Even before the September 11th terror attacks against New York and Washington, D.C., Afghan refugees were fleeing that nation's cities as a result of drought conditions, ongoing warfare, and repression at the hands of the Taliban government. Now, with the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan entering its third week, tens of thousands of refugees are headed toward border areas with Iran and Pakistan, where 4 million Afghans have already sought sanctuary. Exacerbating the crisis is the fear among many Afghan civilians after U.S. bombs and missiles struck non-military targets, including an aid agency's food warehouse, a United Nations compound, an old age home, and residential areas. While the number of refugees has not risen to worst-case scenario estimates, there is concern that with winter approaching, upwards of 7.5 million Afghans will be at risk without adequate food, shelter, or medical care. While the bombing continues, many aid agencies are finding it difficult, if not impossible, to transport food inside the country. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Nicholas De Torrente, Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders U.S. Office, who critically assesses the Afghan refugee crisis and the Bush administration's decision to airdrop military food rations over Afghanistan.
There have been 20 years of war, there have been 3 years of drought, and even before September 11th, we were having really alarming signals as to the conditions inside the country. Malnutrition rates were going up. People were on the move, both inside and also trying to reach neighboring countries even before the September events. Now, since September 11th, the withdrawal of the international aid staff from the Taliban-controlled areas. We're still operational with international staff in the Northern Alliance areas. Having to withdraw from the Taliban areas, just delivering assistance effectively has become much more difficult. We have national staff on the ground who are running our clinics, our hospitals. We're still able to get supplies in to our project, and they are still continuing. But it's insufficient, and we don't have independent witnesses on the ground. It's difficult for us to know what's happening, and therefore, we're really frustrated. We'd like to be able to get back in, but for the moment, that's proven to be very difficult.
What effect is the U.S. bombing campaign over Afghanistan having on the ability of aid groups to get to the refugees and others who are lacking food and lacking shelter?
Well, it's an additional complicating factor. I mean, the main issue for us right now is lack of access, and our programs inside of Afghanistan have been under threat from people on the ground, really from the Taliban and others who are controlling forces. We've had lootings of our compounds in Kandahar, for instance, last week, and also in Mazar. This is a new development. It happened as the bombings were ongoing, so we're seeing sort of a link between the bombing campaign, the effect it has on civilians that are fleeing and are fearful, just an additional stress on their very difficult lives already, and the sort of rising insecurity in the country and the looting of our of humanitarian installations.
Now, the United States government, while it's conducting this bombing campaign over Afghanistan, is also dropping some ready-to-eat military-style meals in the countryside. What is Doctors Without Borders' view of this parallel food drop going on with the bombing?
Well, we're concerned about this. The amounts have increased a little bit. I think they're up to 300,000 rations so far. But still, the amounts are quite insufficient compared to the enormous needs on the ground. And more importantly, we feel that food drops of this nature that are unmonitored, untargeted, and where there's no proper distribution system, really doesn't, there's no guarantee that it will reach those who most need this assistance. these people in the camps or the widows in Kabul, they're not the ones who are able to get this food that is coming from the sky in this form. And the other point, and that comes back to facilitating the operations of independent humanitarian agencies, is that there's a really blurring of lines. When a military plane drops food aid, there is a confusion between humanitarian operations on the one hand and military and political operations and objectives on the other. And that is putting humanitarian programs in danger. It's compromising the neutrality of humanitarian assistance, compromising the impartiality of humanitarian assistance. And we would encourage the U.S. government to make this clear distinction between its military campaign and the humanitarian effort.
So to rectify this in terms of what you see needs to be done, you would have another entity entirely, a Red Cross, Red Crescent, maybe would be dropping off these food packets as opposed to U.S. military planes?
Well, certainly that is the way to go, is to empower and respect the operations of independent humanitarian agencies. The Red Cross, International Committee of the Red Cross, is the prime agency able to deliver vast quantities of aid in war zones. It's done so for many, many years. And this is the type of agency that we should be turning to in situations like this. They have the expertise, the ability, and they make sure that the aid goes to where it's needed.
What has been the Bush administration's response to your request that they separate the food aid from the military campaign?
As the Bush administration has made it plain that they would like to conduct the war on terrorism with a variety of means, and they consider that relief operations are one of the tools that they have at their disposal to achieve their political objectives. And I think that they want to continue with that. I have not seen a positive reply to our concerns, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to convince them that this is the better way to go about it.
As we close here, Nicholas, I wondered if you would speak to the crisis that's looming with winter ahead and many people without shelter, and as we've talked about, without food and medicines. Paint a picture of what's ahead for Afghanistan if the aid doesn't get through and if the hostilities heat up.
I think this is a sort of a deadline that we have. I mean, when winter comes, conditions for the people on the ground in Afghanistan, which is a mountainous country and where we have freezing temperatures in many areas, conditions will become more severe, especially for malnourished and vulnerable people. On the other hand, access to remote areas through mountain passes that become covered with snow become more difficult. So there is a real pressure in terms of time to be able to stock up programs and replenish some of the stocks in Afghanistan to make sure that people are going to make it through the winter. We're looking at, middle of November to be able to achieve that. The other aspect is that, by middle of November, Ramadan is coming, and sensitivities to any military operations will become much heightened throughout Afghanistan and in the Arab and Muslim world. So there's a sort of double deadline that we're facing in terms of being able to access people and in terms of for the military operations as well. And therefore, there's a lot to be done in the month ahead, and we certainly hope that conditions improve so we can achieve those objectives, make sure that aid gets to the people very soon.
That was Nicholas Di Torrente, U.S. Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders. For more information, call toll-free 1-888-392-0392. Or visit the group's website at www.doctorswithoutborders.org. For 10 years, Americans have gathered each November in ever greater numbers outside the gates of Fort Benning, Georgia, to call for the closing of the U.S. Army School of the Americas located there. The school, dubbed by its opponents as the School of Assassins, has provided training to thousands of military officers from all over Latin America, many of whom have returned home to terrorize their own citizens. In an effort to mute opposition, Congress recently changed the facility's name to the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. Following the September 11th terror attacks in New York and Washington, School of the Americas Watch, the organization working to close the training facility, debated whether or not to hold their annual November protest. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with SOA Watch founder Father Roy Bourgeois about the group's decision to go forward with their November demonstration, given the changed climate after the September 11th terror attacks and the status of congressional legislation to close the school.
We really concerned, in a sense, wanting to be sensitive to this new reality we're in. So we called many of our leaders, college students, veterans, nuns, and others around the country about whether they thought we should come back. And overwhelmingly, everyone said we should gather again in November. More important than ever for us to be together to address this whole issue of violence. Violence that's really caused by all these graduates of this School of the Americas down the road who return to their home countries and have over the years killed countless numbers of people. We also, of course, condemn the violence inflicted upon people here at home. And we also feel this is a teachable moment. This is a real time to make connections, to really look at our country's foreign policy in other countries with critical eyes. When we look at Latin America, many of us addressing this issue have lived in Latin America and know firsthand the brutality of the military there and how our country really, for many years, have been allied to oppressive militaries of Latin America that have kept really a small elite very wealthy, very powerful, and the vast majority very poor. We see this school as a school for terrorists. We've always referred to it as a school of assassins, a school for dictators, a school for death squad leaders, and hundreds of graduates from this School of the Americas at Fort Benning have returned to their home countries and they've tortured, they've raped, they've disappeared untold numbers of their people. And you know, they have been terrorists in their countries, and we have armed and trained them with our tax money here.
Have you heard any response, have you had any response from the U.S. government that you may be treated any differently this year when you do your protest as a result of September 11th and its aftermath?
This year, we're being told that because of heightened security on Fort Benning, that we will not be allowed to proceed in this solemn funeral procession. There will be a procession, of course, from the big park where we'll be meeting to the main gate. But it's a more serious atmosphere now. And I can only say that we are being challenged like never before. Some perhaps will not gather, perhaps thinking that it's going to be a little more of a conflict, a little dangerous perhaps. But we don't feel it will. We're going to have 500 peacekeepers, as we always do. Everybody gathering here will go through what we call the nonviolent training.
Are participants in the activities that you're conducting in November being trained any differently than in the past as a result of the changed landscape?
We are moving now into a more serious time. Our faith, our commitment to nonviolence is really being tested. We are really being forced to look deeper into ourselves and ask, you know, how committed really are we to this call to nonviolence? In this new climate of patriotism, we come here in the name of nonviolence. Our movement, last year 10,000 were here, about half are college students. We have a lot of veterans in this movement. I'm a Vietnam veteran, a lot of World War II vets in this movement, Gulf War vets, a lot of senior citizens, nuns, clergy, and others who have worked in Latin America. And we feel that it is very patriotic to come here at this time and simply to say that we do not believe that retaliation and revenge is the way out of this. And we are here really at a very critical time, true. We could be seen as being unpatriotic, but we don't see it that way. It's very important that we gather here, that we keep our voices in the arena to give our side of the issue.
Could you update us on the legislative efforts to close the school? I know that there was a vote in Congress last year that was very close, and you almost succeeded in getting the school closed, but you didn't have quite enough votes. Could you tell us what the status is now, and has this proposed legislation fallen off the congressional calendar as a result of the events of September 11th?
Well, so many things have been put on the back burner, in a sense, but we have Bill H.R., House Resolution 1810, which is a new bill dealing with this new school called now the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. It calls for the closing of this school, to cut off all of its funding. The $15 million or so dollars that comes every year from the taxpayers to train these thugs from Latin America in commando operations, psychological warfare, counterinsurgency, it's all being paid by us, the taxpayer. And what we are saying is we want our legislators to take that money and to put it into schools for our children here at home, or into social programs. And right now we have 80 co-sponsors, very respectable. We have a lot of work to do, but we feel very hopeful. I don't know if we're going to have a vote on this in the fall, but certainly sometimes next year.
That was Father Roy Bourgeois of the School of the Americas Watch. The protest at Fort Benning will take place November 16th through 18th. For more information, call area code 202-234-3440 or visit the group's website at www.soaw.org. One of Mexico's leading human rights attorneys was murdered on Friday, October 19th. 37-year-old Digna Ochoa was shot in the head and leg in her office in Mexico City. A note was left by Ochoa's body warning members of the Miguel Agustin Pro Juarez Human Rights Center that the same could happen to them. After receiving several threats and being held and interrogated by unknown assailants, Ochoa left Mexico for 6 months to work in the United States, returning just this past April. Digna Ochoa defended alleged guerrillas jailed during the 1990s, Zapatista sympathizers, and two indigenous environmentalists opposed to illegal logging who were jailed on what they say were trumped-up drug and weapons charges. In a recent press release, Mexican President Vicente Fox condemned the murder and promised a full investigation, saying the government will punish those responsible. However, human rights groups were quick to blame Ochoa's death on the failure of government authorities to take threats against activists seriously. After taking office in December of last year and ending 71 years of one-party rule, Vicente Fox promised the people of Mexico a new democracy and respect for human rights, a commitment now questioned by human rights groups. Roberto Rodriguez is a columnist and activist based in Texas. He spoke with Between the Lines' Denise Manzari about Digna Ochoa's murder and the anticipated response of the Vicente Fox government.
The human rights situation in Mexico has been like this forever, and, you know, nobody's ever paid attention to it. One of the things that President Fox said, he said he wanted to put forth a truth commission to investigate all the killings of the past, and he has not done that yet. And I think this, if we're lucky, based on his statements that he's made, maybe it will come about. Because the tragedy of this is that it is one of many, many killings, you know, in Mexico's modern history. Now, if you want to know the specifics, you know, she was found dead after having received numerous death threats, you know, and she's been receiving them probably for 5 years, at least five, if not six. But again, even she stopped filing official complaints because nobody pays attention, especially if you're a human rights attorney or deal in human rights, period.
Well, with the transitional government of President Vicente Fox, who ousted the 71-year one-party rule of the PRI, he promised a new democracy and said that he would respect human rights and, as you stated earlier, investigate previous violations and try to prevent future ones. Would you say that he failed in this attempt or didn't attempt enough?
Well, it's not that he failed. The point is he hasn't done what he said he was going to do. And tragically, this may be the impetus. You know, this is going to be probably comparable to the killing of the bishop in Guatemala just about 2 years ago when the Human Rights Commission report was released, and then he was killed right after. I think this is going to have a similar effect. However, he has not stepped forward fast enough.
Well, then President Zedillo at times did claim that he would investigate cases of human rights abuses and attacks on activists. He claimed he would and never did.
Correct. It's because, again, the idea of investigating yourself, he is part of a political structure that, again, it would be the equivalent of the right hand investigating the left hand.
Getting back to Misa Choa for a second, there were two peasant environmentalists, Rodolfo Montiel and Teodoro Cabrera, who protested logging by local Politica, who were imprisoned in May of 1999 on what they say were trumped-up weapons and drug charges. And they were arbitrarily detained and then tortured and are, I believe, still in jail. Do you want to talk a little bit about that case?
Yeah. Look, all I have to go on is my own gut, and I believe that's probably the source of why she was killed. I mean, that case has been followed very closely by many, you know, including myself. I've followed it. You know, they're the equivalent of the activists that fought in the Amazon and then were killed. You know, they were very heroic, and as I think you know, they won human rights awards for their work against logging. Very powerful interest. And I think the reason we have to rely on gut feelings right now is because, again, nobody does anything official. So that's why we're hoping that, yeah, something official is done. You know, they have no business being in prison right now.
Things so far since December of last year, the swearing-in of Vicente Fox, haven't changed too much. He still has, let's say, a little time, and this particular incident can turn it around, and he could make good on his promise. If he doesn't, what is the recourse of people worldwide? I mean, I know that he's supporting the United States in its war against terrorism in the Middle East and Afghanistan. However, on his own turf, there are murders of attorneys that are defending human rights,
yeah. And
nothing is being done. What would you say about that?
If I was going to say, let's give him a chance, well, maybe the next several months should be a good barometer. Because, again, most of the cases that I know are, you know, vicious killings that took place during the Cedillo administration or before. I think the next few months are going to determine whether people take him seriously or not. I believe he's made a statement post September 11th that he, of course, wants to join the fight against terrorism. He has stated that the Zapatistas are not terrorists, to my knowledge, but that all other groups are. And that is dangerous. I think we know that whenever you have government designating who's a terrorist and who is not, you know, many times you have attorneys, you know, winding up dead. You have, again, human rights activists. You have farm worker organizations. You have student groups. All of a sudden, everybody becomes a terrorist. And that's a dangerous path to follow.
That was Roberto Rodriguez, author and activist. For more information, visit the Universal Press Syndicate website at www.uexpress.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Top. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Rich Frazier, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie.